You will have two arguments this morning. The first one is number 212066, PrimeSource Building Products against United States. Mr. Earl.
May it please the court, the president acted lawfully when he issued Proclamation 9980. The trial court reversibly erred when it declared otherwise. This case presents two legal challenges. The first is whether the president acted ultra vires when he issued Proclamation 9980. The second is whether accepting our interpretation of Section 232 violates the non-delegation doctrine. If the court doesn't want me to start elsewhere, I'll address the statutory question first.
And just to be clear, you don't mean anything special about ultra vires. You just mean in violation of the statute.
In violation of the statute, correct. The statutory question here turns on this court's recent decision in Trans-Pacific. In Trans-Pacific, this court rejected the trial court's basis for declaring Proclamation 9980 invalid under the statute. What Trans-Pacific held is that the test to determine whether a proclamation is in line with a downstream tariff proclamation is whether that modification is in step with the announced plan of action by adding impositions on imports to achieve the stated implementation objective. The trial court erred because it did not recognize the possibility of announcement of a course of action, as the president did in Proclamation 9705, or the possibility of a continuing course of action, which is what the president did in Proclamation 9980. In other words, according to Trans-Pacific, the question before the court is whether the new pronouncement constitutes a continuation of a course of action, or whether that action is so divorced from the originating action that it must be deemed a new action for statutory purposes, thereby re-triggering all of Section 232's procedural requirements. In our view, a square application of the Trans-Pacific test should decide this case. First, the text. The text of Proclamation 9980 refers back to the text of Proclamation 9705 multiple times repeatedly. The context of Proclamation 9980 is that it is a complement to Proclamation 9705. In fact, Proclamation 9980 in and of itself seems to make little sense unless it's read as part of a complementary whole. Then there's history. We know that based upon Proclamation 9705, Proclamation 9772, Proclamation 9886, and down to Proclamation 9980, that the president was really focused on achieving a very clear objective, which
Did
was...
Did Proclamation 9705 say anything about steel derivatives?
Proclamation 9705 recognized the president's authority to take action as to steel articles and its derivatives. It then described what action the president was taking and described that action as a first step, and then announced a continuing course of action that the president would instruct the secretary to continue to monitor the situation and determine whether circumstances would warrant an adjustment on that initial step. So we think that this case would fall under the test laid out in the Trans-Pacific
case. In this case, the president received some fresh new information from the secretary in 2018-2019. Is that right?
Correct, right.
What if the president hadn't received any updates like that? Would the president have legitimately been able to issue this proclamation just based on the strength of the secretary report?
On the strength of the secretary, that would be a closer question, Judge Chen.
Because the secretary report didn't say anything about derivatives.
Right, and to be fair, I mean, the secretary's report didn't have to. I mean, the reason why it might present a closer question is I think Trans-Pacific recognized there could be a staleness sort of concern where circumstances change. I think this case is different, though, because here we do know that the president announced a plan of action that he would continue to be advised by the secretary along with other cabinet members, and then he would, you know, he afforded himself the right to adjust his plan of action as necessary as circumstances arose. And in fact, in Proclamation 9980, the president described what those circumstances were in, we think, fairly great detail. He announced that, you know, he had gotten updated information from the secretary, that it appeared that importers were using circumvention efforts, funneling their imports into a different...
Was there a stipulation below that the government can't rely on those updated updates from the secretary?
There is no stipulation below on that issue. In fact, I think the fact that...
Did PrimeSource argue that in the briefing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No. There are two things, I think.
Isn't there some kind of stipulation that the updated communication from the secretary would not itself satisfy the threshold conditions if satisfaction of those threshold conditions were required?
That is correct. So we stipulated that the conferral process described in 1980 did not constitute a new report under subpart B of the statute. So that's what we stipulated to. But our position has always been that a new report was not always required or is not required under the statute because this was part of a continuing course of action. We think that sort of makes sense as we read Trans-Pacific because what Trans-Pacific recognized was that the institution of these time limits in subpart B of the statute was not divesting the president of authority to take or implement some action, you know, with a mandatory, consequentially coercive within these time limits. What the Trans-Pacific Court did was it looked back at history, text, context, and recognized that throughout, you know, the Section 232's existence, the president always had authority to adjust and to address circumstances as they evolved. In fact, in Proclamation 3279, the Petroleum Products Tariff Proclamation, we see over, you know, a 16-year period, 26 modifications. The president made radical amendments to that initial tariff proclamation, even to extend out to derivative products. So there are multiple proclamations within that span of products where the president's, not just President Eisenhower, but downstream presidents are expanding tariff coverage or changing tariff coverage to include derivative products, to change it to a quota or licensing system. So we think that's perfectly in accord with history and practice and the text of the statute as well. Ultimately, we think the trial court erred when it held that the president was not allowed to take action outside the time limits specified in subpart C. We think Trans-Pacific is consonant with our view of the case and that that trial court decision should be overturned.
Can I ask you about one truly minor matter? In Trans-Pacific, we included a footnote that raised a question about whether there was jurisdiction to name the president. Do you know what became of that, or do you have a view about it?
I don't know what became of that. I do know that in this case, the trial court, the majority held that the challenge is against the proclamation itself, not against the president, so thereby it took jurisdiction over that question. There was a concurrence slash dissent by Judge Baker disagreeing with that proposition.
I'm sorry, I don't know what it means to say that the defendant is the proclamation. I thought that's not a sound proposition.
Yeah, I'm not entirely. I don't have a clear answer for you, Judge Toronto. I apologize. I don't think we took a clear position there. I'm not sure what happened in Trans-Pacific. I do think it's sort of an open question. We didn't raise the jurisdictional issue below. That aside, the other side of my friend's argument is that if the court accepts her statutory argument, that there are non-delegation problems. Again, this court in Trans-Pacific evaluated subpart C1 of the statute, looked at the time limits, said even with those time limits, there's not a serious concern about a non-delegation. It still fulfills the intelligible principles test laid out in Algonquin. We think that that same holding would apply here as well. I don't know if there are any other questions. I'll see the rest of my time.
Is there anything in your view that could be remanded, like a possible fact question? Like staleness, for example.
I don't think so, Judge Chen, and I'll explain why. In Trans-Pacific, this court recognized that continuing course of action was allowed. It looked at 9772, and it looked at the face of that proclamation, which is precisely what any court should do. It shouldn't go beyond the face of the proclamation. It shouldn't go into the president's fact-finding. And it said, you know, this makes sense. It looks like it's a continuing course of action. All we're asking is for the trial or the court here to do the exact same thing that it did in Trans-Pacific, which is to look at the face of Proclamation 9980 and make, you know, the determination on the face of that document, whether it's consonant with the continuing course of action laid out in Proclamation 9780.
Even though the period of time between the original and the at-issue one is substantially longer in this case.
Correct, because even in Trans-Pacific, the court didn't go into the question of whether, you know, updated, what information the secretary got, you know, or the secretary conveyed to the president in terms of that updated information. Here, I think the case is even better because the president tells us precisely what information he got. And so I think my friends on the other side want to question the veracity of that information, but again, those sorts of questions are out of bounds according to this court's precedent in Silfab Solar and Florsheim and George Bush, cases like that.
You know, I understand that, you know, some of the broad language in Trans-Pacific and interpreting the statute and how those time provisions aren't necessarily time limits in the way that Prime Source would argue or Trans-Pacific argued. But, you know, just listening to you, it does sound like the government thinks the president's authority here under a continuing course of action is essentially boundless. And is there something you can say to make me feel better to believe that the government believes there are, in fact, some hard boundaries somewhere in here
in terms of
the president's authority to take action, I don't know, decades and decades after the original proclamation?
I understand that concern, Judge Chen. I think you asked the same question in the Trans-Pacific case. I think Trans-Pacific lays out pretty decent guardrails for this case. Again, the test is whether it's in step with what the president did in the initial implementation of his course of action and whether it fulfills that implementation objective. And then it said, let's take each subsequent proclamation on case-by-case basis. As to concerns about staleness, I mean, what I'd point back to is the petroleum products tariff proclamations, right? So in that case, we have over a 20 or 16-year span, 1959 to 1974, 15-year span, 26 adjustments. So really, the period of staleness has to be read against the backdrop of like what we're talking about and what the president's course of action is. So here, I can't say there's going to be a defined time limit. The president said, we want to reach an 80% domestic capacity utilization rate. This proclamation comes, 21 months after Proclamation 9705. We know throughout, the other proclamations, the president is tracking the data and trying to, be faithful to what he said his plan was. So those staleness concerns don't apply here. And I think if we're thinking about how broad the statute extends, it's probably pretty broad if we're looking at history. It could cover decades.
Can you think about any circumstances where there wouldn't be a continuing course of action, either because the secretary hasn't reported something to the president or because it goes outside the bounds of the initial proclamation?
I could think of proclamations. This came up during one of my moods. If there was a steel report and the president said, "I want to cover neckties," okay, that's clearly out of bounds. There were probably closer questions. I think if maybe, and I'm not even sure this would totally qualify, but if there was some report that said, we need to meet a 50% domestic capacity utilization rate, and 50 years later the president issues a proclamation saying, "I'd rather see 100." There's probably a much better argument there that that's not exactly in line with the stated implementation objective, so there could be that issue. But I think the cases just have to be taken on a case-by-case basis, which is what Trans-Pacific recognized. And so when we're applying the principles laid out in Trans-Pacific to this particular case, it doesn't seem to raise the concerns that Trans-Pacific specified in its decision. If there are no further questions, I'll cede the rest of my time and reserve it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Caritas?
Caritas. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Caritas of Perkins Coie, appearing today on behalf of Ullman Fasteners and Huttig. It had been my intention to focus on the text and constitutional bounds of 232 and for my co-counsel, Jeff Grimson, to primarily address the Court's decision in Trans-Pacific and why it is inapplicable to Proclamation 9980 and this case. Having learned of the constitution of this panel this morning, I realized that my plans in that case may have been somewhat naive, and I am, of course, happy to answer any of the Court's questions, including involving the Trans-Pacific opinion. Aside from naked presidential fiat, Proclamation 9980 bears no relationship to either the 2018 Steele Report issued by the Secretary of Commerce, or Proclamation 9705, where the President announced his plan or course of action to address the threat identified by the Secretary of Commerce in the Steele Report. However, as the government was quick to point out in its briefing, the Court cannot review the wisdom, efficacy, or rationale of Proclamation 9980. This is true even though there was indisputably no fact-finding linking the imports of the smattering of steel derivative products that were included in Proclamation 9980 to U.S. steel capacity utilization. In fact, as we pointed out in our brief, the included derivatives amounted to a minuscule amount of total U.S. Imports of steel derivative products, approximately 1% of those, of all U.S. steel products. And less than 1%.
In your view, the president has to, show his work in the proclamation and do some kind of mathematical justification?
Your Honor,
I don't remember us requiring that, or in Trans-Pacific, when the president decided to up the tariffs for Turkey imports from 25 to 50.
Your Honor, the President does not have to show his work. In fact, the President, there is very little that the President has to do under the statute other than follow the procedural limitations of the statute. Really, it is the Secretary...
We're not supposed to review presidential proclamations for substantial evidence, right?
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's precisely...
So I guess what I'm wondering is, I'm not sure where this argument gets you.
Your Honor, the reason for the argument is that precisely because this court cannot question the substantive decision-making of the President, it cannot question either the President's decision to take an action under Section 232 or the particular action that the President determines to take, the only effective review of presidential action and the only way to cabin the President's authority under the delegation of power from Congress are the procedural constraints under Section 232. If those procedural constraints are nullified, essentially the President has writ large to regulate trade and commerce, which are explicitly provided to powers of Congress under the Constitution, not the President. And specifically, the Supreme Court stated in Algonquin that Section 232 does not simply authorize any action the President might take as long as it has even a remote impact on imports. And this court in Trans-Pacific stated its intent to prohibit presidential action that made no sense except on premises that depart from the Secretary's finding in the Steele report. That is precisely what we have here, Your Honors. There was no fact-finding linking these derivative articles and their imports to steel capacity utilization. As Your Honor pointed out when opposing counsel was arguing, the steel report did not have any reference to derivative articles. It spoke only to primary articles of steel and how imports of those articles were endangering the domestic steel industry. Similarly, Proclamation 9705 did not speak to derivative articles at all, but focused on primary product articles of steel and how those imports of those articles were harming the domestic steel industry and how placing limits on imports of those articles would allow the threat to the domestic steel industry to be remedied.
Can I just add, I don't recall exactly, but in the subsection, I think it's B, that discusses what the Secretary's job is as a threshold to any further action. Is there any mention of essentially the remedy question? I thought that B says the Secretary's job is to determine if there's a threat to national security, and Secretary said, yeah, there is, if so much steel is coming into the United States that the domestic steel makers are under utilizing capacity is under utilization will create a problem, but remedy is left entirely to the President. Have I got that wrong?
No, Your Honor, you're correct. I'm sorry, I think there's an issue with the timer. I think the time kept counting down from opposing counsel's argument because I noticed there are only 2 minutes left and I know I haven't been speaking for 13 minutes. Oh, really? Oh, all right. I apologize.
Because you have an 8-7 split.
Yes. Oh, okay, so it takes that into account. Thank you. I apologize. Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
So why is it... even as a statutory matter, a sound view, which I think you're suggesting, that the question of which articles need to be part of a remedy for the problem found by the Secretary, that question itself has to be one that the Secretary addresses.
Your Honor, the Secretary does not have to address that question. The President, when he decided to declare his course or plan of action pursuant to the Steele report, was free to declare a plan of action that diverged from the recommendations of the Secretary in the Steele report, which, as Your Honor correctly points out, the Secretary was not required to provide. But that is simply not what the President did.
Counsel, so you think there'd be a different outcome had the initial proclamation referred to derivative articles and a potential treatment of derivative articles down the road? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there isn't a question that if Proclamation 9705 had said it is my intention to impose duties on steel on these primary articles of steel and these derivative articles of steel, then under this court's decision of Trans-Pacific, that would be the end of the case.
Why isn't it just a little bit more for the Secretary then to come around? The President did say that the Secretary should continue to monitor the situation, and then the Secretary does so, and then lets the President know there's now a new problem with an increase in derivative sales and imports.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, even the note in Proclamation 9705 asking the Secretary of Commerce to continue to monitor the situation says nothing about derivative articles. The only mention of derivative articles in Proclamation 9705 is in a block quote of the statutory text. There is none of the paragraphs wherein the President discusses his plan of action in order to remedy the threat involve any discussion of derivative articles, nor do any of the paragraphs where the President posits what may need to happen in the future.
Given the language of the statute, is it surprising that a President would not address, that a President would address derivative articles? Doesn't the statute refer to derivative articles?
Well, Your Honor, the President was announcing his plan of action. The President has discretion to choose that plan of action, including discretion to determine whether that plan of action does or does not include derivative articles. The question for this Court today is, does Section 232 require the President to announce his plan of action or his course of action within the time frame provided by the statute, which then would allow Congress meaningful oversight over the President's use of Section 232 through the procedure set out by the statute, including the notification provision that requires the President to provide Congress with reasoning for his course of action within 30 days.
You have used more than 1 minute beyond your allocated time. Unless you have an agreement with your co-counsel, I think you're now eating into his time.
If there are no further questions for me, I'm happy to cede my time to co-counsel or stop eating into co-counsel's time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Grimson.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Jeff Grimson for Plaintiff Appellee Prime Source. I have 7 minutes here to cover some ground, some of which will overlap, I think, with Mr. Caritas. But first, I wanted to address a couple of, I'll call them housekeeping points. First is as to whether the government disclaimed any further fact-finding. I refer the Court to the appendix, Joint Appendix 1749, which was a joint status report filed with the Court of International Trade, where when given the opportunity to provide facts, something that met the requirements of a report beyond what was in Proclamation 9980 itself, the government declined and said, we appreciate the opportunity to provide more information. I am going to paraphrase now because this is long. But they said that defendant's position continues to be that the procedural preconditions for the issuance of Proclamation 9980 were met by the Secretary's 2018 Steel Report. That's one thing. So on the question of the possibility of remand, I don't think there are more facts to find. The government counsel referenced the many revisions to original Proclamation 3279, and indeed that was persuasive to the Supreme Court in Algonquin and to this court in Trans-Pacific, where Judge Baker below referred to 13 additional modifications of proclamations on top of the 26 that the Algonquin court had in mind. But I would mention that those all were modifications of the original 3279 of President Eisenhower, which found that, quote, crude oil and the principal crude oil derivatives and products are being imported in such quantities and under such circumstances as to threaten to impair the national security, unquote. So all those modifications have little relevance here, even though they dealt with derivative oil products, because derivative oil products were part of the original threat finding. And that's where we part ways with the situation in Trans-Pacific, which I'll now discuss. So Trans-Pacific does not govern this case. And the government's incorrect that it resolves our case. The majority took pains to limit its findings at 1310, 1323, and 1332, most particularly that the modification on Turkish imports related to, quote, the particular finding of threat at issue. And this is where we get into whether derivative articles were actually mentioned in 9705.
Can I just ask, is the theory of the relationship of the derivatives to the originally tariffed articles that the point is to keep American production of steel sufficiently high compared to utilization capacity. If a bunch of foreign steel is coming in, that's a problem. But if we impose tariffs and those foreign steel makers now don't have quite the market in the U.S. for their steel because of the tariffs, they look elsewhere to sell their steel to foreign steel nails makers, turn that steel into nails. The nails come in without the tariffs, thereby making it more difficult for the U.S. steel makers to produce steel for the making of nails. Have I understood the basic theory? And that doesn't seem very complicated.
The theory is not complicated, and it would not have been difficult for the president to actually comply with the law and have a new finding and a report from the Secretary of Commerce. That finding, the finding by the Secretary of Commerce of a threat, was the key in Algonquin, the key clear precondition, as Justice Marshall called it, why there wasn't a delegation problem. And in this court, in Trans-Pacific, the court found that the modification sufficiently linked back to the threat that was identified. So the economic theory may be perfectly valid. I would take another view of it and say by the government arguing that there was a loophole, they're essentially conceding that derivative articles were actually not covered by 9705. If there was a loophole, it was because something was not covered. Was it difficult? Would it be onerous?
When you mean not covered, you mean there were no tariffs on them? That's not disputed, right?
It's not disputed, but it was also not part of the threat identified. And if I could refer the court to what the president's finding in paragraph 11 of 9705, where the president said, and this is at appendix page 164, kind of in the end of the top paragraph, it is my judgment that the tariff imposed by this proclamation is necessary and appropriate to adjust imports of steel articles so that such imports will not threaten to impair the national security as defined in section 232. The such imports and the steel articles, there's no dispute here that that did not cover derivative articles. Okay, so in Trans-Pacific, when the court found that it wasn't it didn't depart from constitutional or statutory grounds to modify duties on imports of Turkish steel 5 months after the original action, where Turkish steel was identified as part of the threat. There was a sufficient nexus there. We don't have that here. The only word derivative comes up in essentially a copy and paste of the statutory language in the original finding. And that's why, if there is no statutory bound here for what the government can do, our position is that we create a constitutional problem if this is permitted. Derivative articles.
And you don't think that the statute essentially makes the necessary connection of derivatives to the underlying article? There's a finding in B, which B doesn't talk about derivatives or even the particular
That's
mechanism.
Right.
It says there's a finding when certain articles are threatening national security for a particular reason, which is underutilization. And then the statute says when there is that finding that doesn't mention it, derivatives, the president nevertheless can address derivatives because of the obvious tie between derivatives and the article.
I see my time has expired.
Yeah, please. Yeah, yes.
If the president had chosen to take action against steel derivatives in original 9705, I would concede, as my co-counsel did, we probably wouldn't be standing here. Okay, we would be in the trans-Pacific school of thought of a modification of an original adjustment.
So your argument really comes down to the fact that
this is a new action.
The opportunity to exercise the derivative authority does lapse when not exercised initially, even if all that the president has to do is adopt a plan of action with options open.
Exactly right. And if you look at the proclamation underlying the Algonquin case, 4341, that was the proclamation issued after the Secretary of, I think it was Treasury in that time, did make a finding and issue a report, even though the Saxby memo that this court was quite interested in Trans-Pacific said the president did not have to do. He did it in 4341. He issued a new report and a new finding.
I guess an alternative reading of Proclamation 9705 is, based on the secretary's report, I see that there's a national security threat and there's an implementation objective, in my view, which is to get to 80% capacity of domestic steel plant utilization. And so now I'm going to do what I think needs to be done to get there. And here's my first step in taking that action. And in that sense, the president has perhaps reserved all statutory authority to him to make subsequent implementation steps, adjustments in future proclamations.
Our view, Your Honor, is in taking the court's rental car analogy in Trans-Pacific, the president starts with zero constitutional authority to impose duties on imports. He only gets what Congress gives. And in this case, it wasn't the checking out of the rental car. It was how much fuel in the rental car did Congress give the president to keep on driving. That expired after the time limits, and I'm not going to re-argue Trans-Pacific, but I'll say that the president had a limited time opportunity to identify the threat and act promptly, which is what Congress wanted. He did identify the threat. It did not include steel derivative articles. It would be not onerous or irrational to require the president to commission a new report from the Secretary of Congress. It happened in only 19 days in Proclamation 4341, beginning to end. That was the proclamation underlying the Algonquin case. It's not difficult to require the president to go through the procedural steps that are the hook to the statute, that are the hook to the intelligible principle. And because of this, Your Honor, we have a lot of problems with what happened. Most of our claims were shut down by the court below, but we're here on a statutory issue, and we think that the president clearly acted out of bounds here and out of the context of a plan that he had announced.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. O, 5 minutes? We'll have 5 minutes to come close to evening things out if you need it.
I'll be very brief. The trial court's decision should be overturned. The baseline for the trial court's holding runs contrary to this court's holding in Trans-Pacific, and without that underlying baseline, the trial court's decision is incorrect. First, the text. Nothing in the statute says that these deadlines discussed in subpart C1 are strict, coercive, or mandatory or consequential, consequentially coercive. It would be weird to read subpart C1 of the statute, those timelines, as not applying to the articles, but then also applying them to their derivatives. We think it would really create some disjointed interpretation principles in the language of subpart C1. If the time limit doesn't apply to the articles, it also shouldn't apply to the derivatives.
What about the other side's argument that, the president has broad authority under the statute, but then elected to use that authority in a somewhat limited manner, focusing only on articles. And then from that jumping off point, anything that the president wanted to do in a continuing course of action was limited to the scope of what was articulated in the original proclamation, in this particular case, articles only.
That could probably be true in a general sense. I don't think it applies here, though. It could be true in the general sense if, for example, the president never announced a continuing course of action. He just said, I'm going to impose my, tariff, and doesn't mention anything about a continuing course of action, I think you'd have a much stronger case that if the president came down the line and tried to do something else and said, oh, that didn't work, you know, I actually wanted to kind of reserve this right, you'd have a much better case for my friends on the other side. That's not this case, though, because this case is exactly...
You would probably argue against that, though. Presumably, you would find an implicit reservation of modification.
Judge Toronto, I think under this court's decision in
necktie doctrine.
Well, I think there are a lot of interesting hypotheticals we can ask about how far the doctrine stretches. I think there is an argument to be made. I'm not making it here, but there is an argument to be made that those time limits wouldn't even apply if the president didn't reserve for himself that right. But we don't have that case here. What we have here is one where the president did take a first step, did announce a continued course of action, specified what his statutory power was, and we think reserved for himself the right to later make adjustments, including on derivative articles. And again, when we're talking about the time limits here, that time limit argument has already been rejected by this court in Trans-Pacific. It would be weird to apply it to derivatives, but then not apply it to articles when those two are taken together as a noun phrase, articles and their derivatives. So we think that would do a little bit of violence to the text of the statute. Next is the context. When we read the statute as a whole, the manifest purpose of the statute is to address issues of national security. And it says, Trans-Pacific says, don't read subpart C1 as impeding the statutory objective. Reading that language in subpart C1 in such a narrow and categorical way, we think, would actually obstruct the statutory purpose, which is exactly what Trans-Pacific countenanced against. Then we have history. Trans-Pacific referred back to the history of what these proclamations were doing, including the petroleum products cases where the president announced a tariff imposition on articles, petroleum products, and then over a decade later, adjusted that tariff proclamation to start covering derivatives. That was perfectly acceptable under the previous iteration of the statute. Trans-Pacific recited the previous iteration of the statute to indicate that these time limits don't change the calculus. And so we think the same reasoning would apply in this case. My friend's argument on the other side...
Do you recall in the petroleum situation what the underlying finding of the threat to national security was that would be a counterpart to the finding here that domestic capacity is underutilized, and if it continues to be underutilized, that the steel plants will shut down?
I will confess that I don't recall. I apologize. The nutshell argument for my friends on the other side is I think they're trying to elevate this rigid sense of formalism over substance. They're saying you didn't expressly reserve the right in Proclamation 9705 to later adjust for derivative articles. We would argue the president has done that. He recognized his statutory power. He implemented a course of action. He said what he was doing as to articles was his first step, and then he told the secretary to continue to monitor the situation and that he would make adjustments as necessary. We think the trial court reversibly erred when it said the president couldn't do that. We respectfully request that this court overturn the trial court's judgment.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel, and the case is submitted.